Good morning. Connor's going to give his presentation, so Connor, take the stage.
Okay, hello. My name is Connor Geiger. I will be presenting to you guys about Octane. Okay, cool, yeah, it works. So, what is Octane? Octane is a compound made up of carbon and hydrogen atoms, making a hydrocarbon compound. The compound itself is C8H18. As you see to the right. It is a colorless liquid, and it is very flammable. Physical and chemical properties of octane. It has a density of 0.703 grams per milliliter. It's less dense than water. The melting point is negative 57 degrees Celsius. Boiling point is 126 degrees Celsius. The flash point of the compound is 13 degrees Celsius. It is insoluble in water, and it is both flammable in liquid form and vapor form. The main uses of octane. Octane is used as an additive in our fuel. So basically, it inhibits pre-ignition, which is pre-ignition is when the fuel ignites under compression before the desired point of compression ratio, which this is inside of your engines. So this is actually what makes your engines blow. And so this is why when you go to the gas station, you see different grades of gas, like 87, 89, and 92 is what we see in Oregon. And so that's just the octane level of ratings. And which this means is that the higher the rating of the octane gas, the more resistant the gas is to pre-ignition. And so the high compression engines and like forced induction engines, so like turbo or supercharged engines, they need a higher rating gas. Probably compared to you guys' daily drivers, they probably need like 87 octane just because their ratio and their pressure ratios in their engines aren't as high. So, with that being said, gas! It's in your cup!
And it's in your butt.
And it's on my mind.
Alright, let's light some stuff on fire.
Running the jug is a little bit different than what happens in your engine. Because in your engine, the air is under compression. And compressing air makes for a different challenge. Air is a bunch of molecules all rubbing against each other. And when the air gets compressed, those molecules rub together more. And when they're rubbing together more, they generate heat. So more compression means more heat. In a hot engine, there's a chance that fuel will combust without a spark. And that's called engine pain, or pre-ignition. And that's bad. If the explosion happens at the wrong time, you're not going to get the performance you should. The piston and the combustion are working against each other, and you risk damaging your engine. Originally, they fixed it by adding lead to the fuel, because lead made the gas more stable at high temperatures. No more pain. But we stopped doing that because putting lead in everything is dumb, and it hurts your brain. That's why all the gas at the pumps say unleaded. It's also why paint chips don't taste as good anymore. Guys, what are we doing? I have my chips.
What's with all these numbers on the pump?
87, 89, 91. Well, that's the octane rating. The higher the octane rating, the more resistant the gas is to pre-igniting.
What the hell is an octane rating?
Octane is a chemical like gas that's super resistant to spontaneous ignition. So we use it as a standard to measure gasoline. The octane rating, that's the number you see at the pump, is not how much octane is in the gas. It's just how well the gasoline mixture resists ignition under pressure compared to octane. For example, 87 octane is 87% as good as octane at reducing pre-ignition. So that's why high-performance cars with turbochargers and high-compression engines gotta make sure they use high-octane gas so it doesn't combust early under all that added pressure.
Is higher-octane gas better for my engine?
Not necessarily.
Will higher-octane gas help clean my engine?
No! High-octane gas will not ignite until it's supposed to. That's what it means. If you don't drive a car that needs higher-octane gas, well, you're better off using 87 like the rest of us peasants. So, start...
Yeah, that's cool. All right, next up. give me just a second here. We'll transfer it back to...
Okay.
Oh, right, yeah, totally. That was a cool video, man. All right. On Friday, we left off with an example of how if you take the raw protons and neutrons and you add them together, they almost never equal the actual mass of the atoms you're creating. So this is an example of deuterium, which is a hydrogen 2. So it's got one proton, that's what the lower left number means, and 2 minus 1 means it has one neutron. And if you take the actual values of the proton and the neutron, and you compare them to the actual values of deuterium, the mass going in is greater than the mass going out. So delta is always final minus initial. Final would be deuterium, this number, minus initial, the protons and neutrons going into it. Mass is lost. And this is kind of a bad thing for chemistry so far. Balancing reactions, all this kind of stuff we've done, limiting reactants, etc., etc. We wanted to make sure that the mass going in was equal to the mass going out. So what's happening with this reaction and why it's actually okay is that this is something you can relate back to an energy transfer. And if you think about it, at the beginning of time, after the Big Bang and stuff, you had initially a bunch of energy, which then started forming protons and neutrons. There had to be a reason why the atoms formed at all. And this equation, which is one of Einstein's equations, E equals mc squared, is a way to justify why atoms form at all. Now, if you're going to turn a mass into an energy, energy is a joule, you have to use kilograms per meters squared divided by second squared. So what happens here is, here's the speed of light, 2.998 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. And this is a good thing that I'd like you to know, but we haven't had to use so far this term. If you square the speed of light and you multiply it by the change in mass in kilograms, so the previous number, I believe, was 0.00239. That was grams per mole. If you divide it by 1,000, that'll turn it into kilograms per mole. And the reason we do that is because a kilogram meters squared per second squared is another way to say a joule. Joule is what they call a derived unit. Don't be too worried about that. The important thing is just you have to turn your grams per mole into kilograms per mole. But anyway, the number that pops up, minus 2.15 10 to the 11th joules per mole, that's a big number, all right? And that's saying that a very small change in mass can lead to a very small change, a very large change in energy. And if you convert this a little bit over into what's called a binding energy is the opposite of the actual change in energy, and I turn my joules into kilojoules, this number pops out, and this is the binding energy of deuterium. And it's this number which really justifies, in my world, why the atoms want to form. This is for, as I said, deuterium, but you can do a similar process for any atom. In the problem set this week, the last problem, we'll do a problem like this for a phosphorus 31 versus a phosphorus 30, and you'll also get a very, very large number. Now, the scientists that think about this a lot of times they will do some other things for it. But I do want to focus on the fact that this number, the initial number we had, very negative, very exothermic. And again, this is just justifying why the atoms want to form. All right, you have to get energy out. It's like getting a payday. All right, atoms form because lots of energy is released in the process. So that's why we have carbon and stuff like that. But there's one more really interesting thing you can do with this stuff. A lot of times people will take that energy, the binding energy, and they'll divide it by the number of nucleons. Now, a nucleon is just a particle in the nucleus. So in this case, because it's hydrogen 2, remember that 2 is the mass number, protons plus neutrons. So if you take the number, the binding energy, and you divide it by, in this case, 2, you'll end up with this number, which is the kilojoules per mole of nucleons. So for every part in the nucleus, protons and neutrons, for every part, you're going to get this much energy out. And there's something really interesting you can do with that. But before I go to the next slide, questions on this process right here. Okay. This amount, they feel, is what the strong force does. All right, we talked about how in the nuclear world, the strong force contributes to stabilizing the nucleus, while electromagnetic, the positives, negatives, which are what most of chemistry is about, the positive negatives actually tend to destabilize the nucleus. The nucleus has a bunch of positive protons very, very tight to each other. They don't really want to be there. So this is one way to interpret how powerful the strong force actually is. Cool. So in this case, hydrogen 2, the hydrogen 2 has one proton because it's hydrogen, and 2 minus 1 is 1 neutron. So the nucleons are nothing more than the number of protons plus neutrons. So in this case, it's just like dividing by 2. Rami, if you had phosphorus 31, like in the problem set this week, the 31 is the number you put in the bottom, all right? If it was carbon 12, the 12 would go in the bottom. Good question. Another question. All right. This number right here, 1.08 times 10 to the 8th kilojoules per mole of nucleon, if you take all of the atoms known, so the ones I was just talking to Rami about, like phosphorus and carbon, you end up with this very interesting graph. And believe it or not, this is a profound moment in the Chem 221 through Chem 223 series, right here. And what we're seeing, all right, is that more or less it increases up to about here, and then it starts decreasing again. Now remember that in the physical science world, all right, to have a reaction happen, you need to get energy out. And that's analogous to in the real world, like you have to make money. If you don't make money, then you're not doing it. All right. Well, that's cheesy and I apologize. But anyway, in my chemistry world, you have to get energy out to make something happen. What this graph says is that there is a maximum amount of binding energy for iron 56. Iron 56 is the top of the hill, and the atoms to the left of iron 56 want to be like iron 56. The atoms to the right of iron 56 want to be like iron 56 too. The ones to the left will undergo something called fusion, and fusion is a nuclear process we'll talk about here in a little bit, where lighter atoms combine to make heavier atoms. So if the atoms are under iron 56, then generally they will undergo fusion to be more like iron 56. The atoms to the right, though, will undergo what's called fission. And fission is another nuclear process where larger atoms are broken down to smaller atoms. These will undergo atoms to be more like iron 56. But what I want to ask of you right now, what happens when everything is iron 56? Are we going to have fusion or fission energetically? No. Iron 56 is the end all of all the universe. And I say this with no sense of sarcasm, if you can believe it or not, with my sense of humor, I know it comes out. But iron 56 is literally the ending point of everything. Now, I've babbled before how our DNA is going to all go to CO2 and water and stuff like that, and thank heavens for high activation energies and stuff like that. What I wasn't telling you is that even the CO2 in the water will be like iron 56, and all of the molybdenum which we have in our body, and the uranium in Hartford and stuff like that, plutonium, all those kind of things. One day they will be like iron 56. So you can argue in a very pessimistic, dark way of thinking of the world that one day the whole universe will be iron 56, and that's it. Now, don't despair, all right? Because just like it takes a long time for diamonds to convert to graphite, and you shouldn't go sell your diamonds because your children's children's children will have it, this is such a high energy process with an incredible energy of activation that it will take gazillion years, I don't know how to use it, in more than a trillion years, this kind of thing, to even begin to approach this kind of process. But if you think about these things in what will be the final state of the whole universe, I would argue that Iron 56 is it. But again, that's so long in the future. You can still have the whole Star Trek, Star Wars universes and stuff like that. Still have big battles. It's a very big process. The energy of activation, thankfully, is really high for these things. But if you think about the world from a physical science perspective, Iron 56 will one day be what everything is. Absolutely, right. There's always these things about, you know, the whole, why did the Big Bang happen in the first place? Could we be created and stuff? Absolutely. I'm an optimist and I like science fiction, so I have to answer yes in there. Absolutely. So that's why some people will go off on gloom and doom. You know, and I appreciate Gothic culture, but I once had a friend who was really obsessed with this, and you can't think those kind of ways either and stuff. But it is kind of an interesting thing philosophically. We'll talk about entropy in Chem 223, which is another part about this too that makes me a little questionable, wrong on it. Good. All right, so Iron 56 is the most stable thermodynamic element isotope, period. And that's why even when suns blow up, novas, supernovas, stuff like that, they stop at Iron 56. They cannot make smaller atoms into bigger atoms because of this curve, all right? So Iron 56 is really kind of the end-all thermodynamically. Less atoms with less than 26 protons, so that includes us with carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, stuff like that, they will undergo what's called fusion to become more like Iron 56, and we'll talk about fusion. We'll also talk about fission, which is what the atoms larger than 26 protons will undergo. So all of the lead and all of the molybdenum and sulfur and stuff like that, those will all undergo fission to become more like Iron 56. But again, and Rami's point is really important, just because this is, quote-unquote, the end-all thermodynamically, remember that the kinetics of these things are just incredibly slow, all right? So if the diamonds going into graphite is okay, and I promise it is, this is many, many, many orders of magnitude larger than that. But it is kind of interesting to think about as a scientist and as a human being, of course. Any questions? So, if you wanted to find, or you had a question like this, where you wanted to predict what was the highest binding energy per nucleon, and here's four or five different pieces, you'd want to pick the one which was closest to iron 56, all right? And lithium and helium are, of course, much smaller than iron 56. Thorium is, of course, much larger than iron 56. But the one which is closest to iron on the periodic table, all right, is good old nickel. So nickel, number 28 on the periodic table, is closest in the periodic table to iron. So you would pick the one that was closest to iron. Is that cool? Yeah. Yeah, that would work too. You bet. That's right. Either the lower number or the upper number would work. So yeah, if nothing else, then yeah, think about it, Nathan. Like the iron 26 is close to nickel 28, but honestly, the upper numbers work fine too. Yeah, good. Excellent point. Other questions? Okay, so real quickly then on fusion. Fusion takes smaller atoms and basically pushes them together. And so something new is made. So here's deuterium, hydrogen 2, and tritium, hydrogen 3, making essentially an alpha particle and a neutron. And again, the energies of fission and fusion are just massive, all right? Like when you take a sodium metal and you place it in water, you'll have maybe 10 to the third kilojoules per mole. These processes will be much larger in magnitude, and that's why we're dealing with it here. So fusion is just that. The problem with fusion is that you do need a pretty high energy source to make the fusion happen. So we do need to use something called plasma, which is another fascinating part of this whole field, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Making plasma is not easy, and we'll see this here in a little bit. But the advantage of fusion is that the products are very clean, and usually the reactants are pretty clean. So if we're starting to make this reaction happen and there's a circuit going bad or something like that, well, we'll have a lot of hydrogen, no smoking in the lab because it's flammable, and maybe some helium, which will, if it's not too high energy, make us talk like chipmunks, but we won't have like plutonium waste and these kind of nasty things that we'll see that fission has. So that's kind of a cool thing about fusion. Now, plasma is what you need to get these processes started. And believe it or not, in all of the universe, there's more than just solids, liquids, and gases. And of course, this term, we've done so much with each of those. But plasma is actually the fourth state of matter. And the plasma is kind of like a flowing gas, is how I've been described to me. It is like a liquid, it's a fluid and stuff, but it conducts electricity really well. In a plasma, the electrons are usually dissociated partially or completely from the nucleus. So it's like you have this electron field over the positive field. It's very, very interesting. What's also interesting, though, about plasma is even though in Chem 220 series we spend the least time talking about it, it is the majority of the universe because the sun and lightning and these kind of things all made essentially of plasma. And when you think about all the mass of the universe, most of the masses are in suns, all right? So really most of the universe is plasma, but it's very rare on the Earth, so that's why we don't talk about it as much. Here's a little graph that shows some sources of plasma. And again, like suns and stuff like that are basically just big plasma generators. If you saw the eclipse last summer and there was that kind of glow around it, which was amazingly cool, that corona is from a plasma ejection. So that's the kind of plasma you're looking at. But lightning is a good source of plasma here on the Earth. Some fluorescent lights involve plasma, which is kind of cool. The solar wind, if you've seen the aurora borealis and stuff at night, those kind of things would be from plasma as well. And arguably, you can see plasma in your microwave.
There's a match head.
So these were two brothers that took my class a few years ago, and they were like, hey, Russell, we can make plasma in our microwave. And I'm like, I'm like, come on, seriously? And they said, yeah. And they said, well, you make a video. Well, they did. And I was like, huh, that was kind of bright. And they basically used cut grapes with match heads, and they thought that then this bright light appears. So I'm like, oh, come on, man. So I did some pretty good research on this in the literature, and I must admit, I found some things that sounded convincing that maybe it was plasma. And I was like, oh, come on, this is sulfur, just a fire, or something like that. But there was some research done that shows that perhaps that really is plasma, generally that really bright light, because plasma has a lot of energy. So I don't know. I can't discredit it. I'm not 100% convinced, but maybe you can. Be careful with your microwave if you try this. You'll see lots of experiments online how to do it. I don't know, but maybe we just saw plasma there. Anyway. Fusion, I really believe, is the energy source of the future. And in shows like Star Trek, they're always using fusion reactors and stuff because it would be a really nice source of cheap energy. And they're getting to the point now where fusion is becoming more probable. But this, again, the problem is getting that plasma to go. So one of the ways that people invoke fusion right now is through a tokamak reactor. It's kind of like a big donut, all right? And in the donut, which you can see the inside of right there, the plasma basically goes around. And as the plasma goes around, and you have to make sure everything is magnetically sealed and stuff like that, the fusion process will occur. And again, it's pretty high energy, so that's why you need these really high energies. And the goal is to have less energy put in compared to the energy that comes out. And they have done this now in Germany. It's just kind of on the cutting edge and stuff, but one day I hope fusion will be around. This is supposedly the inside of the tokamak reactor.
Plasma, the fourth state of matter. It represents more than 99% of the total matter in the universe.
So again, this was tacky and basically an advertisement for this thing. This is the inside, again, of the tokamak. There's a person standing, so you have a gauge. On the outside is just an amazing array of magnets and stuff like that. In 2015, they and Max Planck Institute in Germany, they feel they had more energy come out than in it. But again, they did it for 30 minutes, and that's a good start. So it's getting there. All right, it's not quite there, but it is getting there. So hopefully one day a lot of our energy will come from here.
In the nuclear fission of uranium-235, a neutron collides with a uranium atom, causing it to fission into two smaller nuclei. On the average, 3 neutrons are emitted for every U-235 atom that divides.
So fission is what the heavier elements use to break down to lighter elements. So this would be things like uranium, a common example. And again, all of these things want to be like iron, so they will break down into smaller things. So in this case, the uranium is breaking into a krypton and a barium. And a lot of times you need what's called a neutron trigger, which is kind of like a bullet, if you will. It blasts into the bigger atom, and the bigger atom is released. A lot of energy comes out of it, which is really cool. But the reason I showed the second video, which was basically a ping pong ball on a bunch of mouse traps with ping pong balls, is that what happens is sometimes one neutron in will create multiple neutrons out. So you have to be very careful. You have to control those neutrons, or else
if the mass of U-235 is less than the critical mass, no chain reaction will result. Most of the neutrons will escape to the surroundings. If the mass is critical, most of the neutrons will be captured by other U-235 atoms, and an uncontrollable chain reaction will occur. This is the explosion of a thermonuclear bomb.
So bombs are basically uncontrolled reactions. A lot of energy is given out, and that's not what we want for power sources, shall we say, politely. So anyway, you need to control these kind of things. So there's a lot of fission power plants in lots of different countries. France is currently, I feel, one of the leaders of this area. They have, and there's heat pumps and all kinds of other stuff going through it. But the problem is with fission is that you're always going to end up with other nuclei, and the other nuclei may or may not be totally safe. So one thing that France, I think, is pretty impressive of is they're able to recycle a lot of their waste. In the United States, when we did a lot of fission in the 70s, and even here in Oregon and the Columbia, northwest of us here, there was a Trojan nuclear power plant. The waste was just perpetual, all right? It would be around for millions and millions of years, and who wants to do that kind of stuff? So the problem with fission is that you do get a lot of energy out, but you have to take into account the waste that's created, and storing the waste can be problematic.
Located in the nuclear core of a fission reactor are fuel rods, moderator and coolant fluid, and control rods. Each fuel rod contains tiny pellets of uranium dioxide. In these hundreds of fuel rods, fission occurs, producing an average of 2.5 neutrons per fission reaction. The fuel rods are surrounded by water, which acts as a moderator by colliding with the neutrons and slowing them to a low thermal level. The water absorbs the thermal energy, which is used to drive a steam turbine to generate electricity. The low-energy neutrons enter other fuel rods and collide with uranium-235 nuclei, creating additional fission chain reactions and the release of more neutrons. The amount of low-energy neutrons present is regulated by control rods made of boron, which are very effective at absorbing neutrons. These rods are raised out of or lowered into the core as needed to sustain the chain reaction at the desired level.
Our society needs energy, there's no question about that. And fission is definitely a source of energy that's totally possible. But again, there's lots and lots of energy, and if your boron rods, which control the neutrons, aren't working, then you can start having uncontrolled things. I feel that there are four real problem events when it comes to fission. Some of these you may have heard of, and maybe you haven't, but the first one was Three Mile Island, which was actually in Pennsylvania in 1979. Chernobyl, definitely in 1986, in the Ukraine was a huge problem, lots and lots of things. Fukushima, very recently in Japan, after the tsunami and stuff like that, they had problems. But the most frustrating one to me is the one here in Washington, in Hanford. And if you go along the Columbia by the Tri-Cities and stuff, Richmond and stuff, Hanford plant right there is the place where they made a lot of plutonium, especially for World War II, and then later for medical things. But you have a lot of waste there now, and what are you going to do with the waste? So again, fission is problematic. It's a troubled child. Fusion, on the other hand, would be a clean source of energy. The waste that's created would be like helium and lithium, the stuff that goes in, much more benign. But again, it's still a little cutting edge when it comes to that technology. So, one of the heroes of this section that really doesn't get enough credit, in my opinion, her name is Lisa Mittner, and she was one of the people that helped discover the process of fission, the heavier atoms going to lighter atoms. And Lise Mittner is really an interesting thing. Her and Hahn and Strassmann and Frisch were the ones that really came up with the idea of what fission was all about. Element number 109 is named for her, MT, which is kind of cool. But the reason I don't think she gets enough credit is that, first of all, let's be honest, she was female in a time where that wasn't looked at well. So just like Marie Curie was working out in the shed where it got super hot in the summer and cold in the winter, she was working in some kind of a basement. And Otto Hahn kind of, in my opinion, kind of stole a lot of the results of her work, just like Francis Crick did and stuff for the woman that did the X-ray stuff for DNA. She was also, though, a pacifist. She would not participate during World War II. She went to Switzerland and remained neutral, and of course at the time, pretty aggravated pro-Nazi, anti-Nazi feelings. That also kind of dominated her thing. So she was definitely a cool woman, and I think she deserves more credit, so that's why I'm bringing it up here. She was part of this thing. If you have nothing else to do, read about her. She's cool. But anyway.
Even some everyday objects contain radioactive sources. Let's see how a Geiger counter responds to these items. First, we look at the background reading. Listen for the rate of the counter clicks and observe the meter response. Smoke detectors use a shielded americium-241 source. Smoke detectors should never be disassembled, as has been shown here for demonstration purposes. Now we observe the response of the Geiger counter to a lantern mantle. Lantern mantles can be obtained at any sporting goods store. This brightly colored orange Fiestaware plate contains uranium oxide in the glaze. The radiation level is high enough to be dangerous if exposure is prolonged. The blue Fiestaware plate has a non-radioactive glaze.
True story, I was in Walport, Oregon, at kind of like a secondhand store, and my son and my wife were with me. We were just looking around and stuff, and came across this huge display, orange Fiesta wear, classic. And I was like, okay. So I grabbed my son and my wife, and we got out of there, man, because the orange Fiesta wear, radioactive glaze all over it, man. Now, when you see that orange Fiesta wear, especially when it says classic, you get out of there, man, because it was using a type of uranium, which was radioactive. And you want to be very, very careful with it. Now, they have orange stuff now that doesn't have it, all right? So you have to be careful. But this was classic, and I was like, oh, we are so out of here. Anyway, Geiger counters are what's used to detect if there's radiation or not, and you can tell if that one was beeping. Yeah.
So how's that allowed to be sold if it's so radioactive?
Unless you have a Geiger counter, and of course I didn't have one on me at the time because I was in Walport, but you can't really even show it to someone then to tell them and stuff. But yeah, I mean, you should send that away. You should, I mean, I hate to say it, but even in a landfill would be better than right there on the shelves of this, you know, classic store. But yeah, you're seeing how little science knowledge can be good and it can be bad at the same time. But in this case, I think it's good. The other types of Fiesta wear, by the way, are fine, so I'm not trying to discourage you from having that stuff. All right. Health is, of course, a big thing in all this, because when you're exposed to these kind of things, whether it's Fiesta wear or some kind of radiation source, it's nice to know. Now, I will not be asking you questions on these kind of things, but I do want to introduce some of the types of units that are used to express health. The Röntgen, which is named after one of the people that did a lot of x-ray work, is one type of wave, and it's supposedly proportional to air ionization. It is used for x-rays and gamma rays. Those are both the highest forms of energy. A chest x-ray supposedly is 0.1 R, all right? And I don't know that much about it, how to correlate it. There is what they call a REM, which is a Röntgen equivalent for man or human, if I might be so bold and stuff like that. What I have been exposed to most of the time is the Curie, named after Marie Curie. One Curie is equal to 3.7 times 10 to the 10th DPS, disintegrations per second. And that's saying that every second there are 10 to the 10th atoms undergoing a radioactive transformation. Now remember, when you have 10 to the 23rd of something in any one sample, 10 to the 10th is a small percentage of that 10 to the 23rd. So one Curie would be a lot of atoms decomposing per second, which is totally fine. There's also RADs, which are 10 to the minus 5 joules absorbed per gram of material. And if you have a whole body dose of 450 RADs, this gets you to what's called LD50. Does anybody know, especially after class presentations, what that is? Yeah, you did it, right?
Yeah, little dosage, 50%.
Well done, Eleanor. Perfect. LD50, lethal dose to 50% of your population. So if all of us in this room had a 450 rad dose, half of us would be dead. That's a terrible thing, and I hate talking about LD50 because I'm, you know, animal lover. But anyway, that's what the LD50 means. Yeah, so it's used a lot of times with animals and stuff to expose things. So. All right. So, I'd like you to think about which one of these makes sense with a little bit of sense of humor at the same time. We should try and live as radiation-free as possible. Yes, all radiation is bad, and it's best to have no radiation exposure at all. Reasonable? We all want to say yes, but is it reasonable? No, you're going to have radiation from the space coming down. The Earth itself has actually lots of radiative processing, thinning stuff up. It's true you want to keep away from radiation, but you're not going to get rid of it all. Every time you take an airplane, you're going to have more exposure than if you stay on the ground, etc., etc. Some places in caving, when you go, if you're a splinter, then you'll have more radiation exposure as well. So you will never get away from it all the way together. So B, yes, we gather some radiation exposure naturally due to geological processes in the Earth and from space, so some is natural and normal, and that's the answer, all right? You can't get away from it all right? We should try and live radiation possible. No, we can trust the government, don't go there. I like Peter Parker, don't go there either, and Bruce Banner, of course, the Hulk with gamma rays, not really radiation, that would be probably the worst answer of all. Anyway, I want you just to realize here, regardless of my silliness, that yeah, some radiation radiation is going to be okay, and it is around us all the time. Okay. You can transform atoms into hybrid atoms using a variety of processes. And again, this is one of those things I just want to introduce. You do not need to know these kind of terms. But if you've heard about a linear accelerator or a cyclotron, those are ways basically just to take smaller atoms, smash them together, and hopefully get larger atoms out. Now, the cyclotron, which was really useful in the beginning of the 20th century especially, was great for discovering some of the different pieces. Linear accelerators now are basically a more powerful version of the cyclotron, which does basically the same thing. And if you're interested in this kind of science, this is a really cool kind of thing to get into. This is a picture of CERN, which is in Switzerland, and it's basically just a huge linear accelerator, all right? And they circle these things, and they go around in the circle, round, 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 until finally they smash together, and they can find new nuclei. It's also being used to find the Higgs boson, you know, those different particles and stuff, the Higgs boson, that's what it is, sorry. They can do lots of really interesting things, and it's a very, very expensive project, and for a while their liquid helium system wasn't working, so the whole thing was shut down. But anyway, it's kind of cool what they're doing there. Astronomers and chemists will sometimes work together in order to find the origin of elements, all right? So all of the orange, the yellowish ones right there are supposedly from exploding massive stars. But hydrogen and helium are a good example of things that have been around since the Big Bang. So you can tell how they're trying to figure out where the elements come from, all right? And some of them, of course, they don't know. Those are the gray ones. Those are also the lowest, though, abundance, usually, of the different things and stuff. So merging neutron stars. This is kind of cool stuff to read about more, too, if you're interested in this. So.
My main MC, Alpine Cat.
With the serendipitous D.O.B.
Just a B-drop.
Teaching is one of this lab's main theme. It's the place to introduce me to physics of beings. They accelerate nuclei, the protons and neutrons at the centers of atoms. We call them nuclei. Protons define the elements of chemistry. Neutron numbers affect elements with subtlety. They define the isotopes, and with effort they hope to make some that no one's ever seen before. That's dope. So you put the elements from the periodic table, but this other version highlights isotopes that are stable. The isotopes we know are on a diagonal track, and at first glance, I thought it looked pretty whack. But as you get away from that school, baseline is radioactive isotopes we don't usually find on Earth. Because the nuclei prefer to decay into more stable isotopes by tossing particles away before they can. The teams here check out their dynamics, measure masses and lifetimes, and study their mechanics. They're building at grid with mysteries to solve, like what reactors drive start, and how did they evolve the strong force behind nuclei? But we still can't say exactly why some are stable while others decay. A more powerful machine can push the frontier. The physicists here, they get nuclear. So let's say you were making a new kind of nucleus in Everett, a plant facility that's long been discussed. The starting atoms, they're just ordinary stable isotopes. They're easier to store and carry. You strip off their electrons for a charged state. They zip through electric fields made to accelerate. Then you slam them into something. We call it the target. 5% of your nuclei are gonna really get it. Those that do will be different from your starting crew. They've lost protons and neutrons, or maybe gated through. All kinds of fragments have just been created, so you put them through a magnet, they can get them separated. If it's got lots of protons, it takes an inside curve, but more neutrons tend to drag it for an outside swerve. You filter out the isotopes you don't want in the stream, and will not. You've got a rare isotope beam, and to put your nucleus on the nuclear map, you'll then measure it in a detector, a trap. This facility is for research and to teach, so that you can be more than just a figure of speech.
This video actually goes on for quite a bit longer, but I like this part because it does show how they have the smaller ones going into the larger ones, and only about 5% of them actually make the larger ones, and they're using elaborate magnets to detect the heavier mass ones. Michigan would be a good place. If you're interested in this kind of science, check them out, man. They're pretty cool. Anyway, one of my heroes.
After graduating from UCLA with a major in chemistry in 1934, I went to Berkeley to obtain my PhD in chemistry in 1937. And then a few years later, I became involved in the research to synthesize and identify the so-called trans-uranium elements. Uranium has the atomic number 92 and is the heaviest naturally occurring element. And what we did was go on to produce by nuclear bombardment elements with atomic numbers greater than 92. For example, 93, 94, 95, 96, and so forth. The most important one, of course, is the element with the atomic number 94. Plutonium, which has the fissionable isotope that is used in atomic energy and was used in the atomic bomb that brought an end to World War II when it was used at Nagasaki. We named plutonium after the planet Pluto, just like uranium had been named after Uranus and neptunium after Neptune. We could have given it the name plutium after the root Pluto, but we like plutonium better, and we should have given it the symbol PL, but we like PU better, and we thought maybe we would be criticized for giving it that kind of a symbol. We went on, after I moved to Chicago, to work on the chemical processes for the separation of plutonium for its use in the atomic bomb, to the metallurgical laboratory of the University of Chicago, and here we went on to discover the next two elements with the atomic numbers 95 and 96. And in order to do this, we had to predict the chemical properties using the periodic table, but the form of the periodic table at that time was wrong, and I changed it and created the actinide concept for placing the heaviest elements in the periodic table. For this, I received the Nobel Prize in 1951. So that shows you how easy it is to do work that would give you a Nobel Prize. One of the elements that interests me very much that we synthesized is the element with the atomic number 106, which has been given the name by the discoverers, of which I am one, seaborgium, with the symbol SG. The Commission on Nomenclature of Inorganic Chemistry of the International Union of Purified Chemistry that have to approve this name rejected it because I'm still alive. And they could prove it, but there was such a universal disapproval of that action that it now looks like the name seaborgium for element 106 is going to remain. And of course, I'm very pleased about that. This is a very high honor. I think it's a greater honor than even receiving the Nobel Prize, because it'll last forever. The name seaborgium will be in the periodic table 100 years from now, 200 years, 1,000 years from now. Actually, a total of 20 trans-uranium elements have been synthesized since that first synthesis of element 93 and 94 in 1940 and 41. So that now we're up to element 112. And it looks like it's going to be possible, as the years go on, to synthesize and identify perhaps another half dozen transuranium elements. I think this will occur after I'm gone, but perhaps during the lifetimes of many of you, and perhaps some of you will be involved in the discovery of these additional transuranium elements.
This shows the peninsula of stability which we talked about on Friday, and then sometimes people predict that there will be these islands of stability up here where you have additional elements that will be stable. And Seaborg really was kind of criticized because he was alive when they wanted to name it for him. Obviously, that was overcome. And now element 106, which is right there, SD, is named after him. So it's kind of cool. He did the whole actinide thing. I don't have time to show the nuclear chemistry radiocarbon dating, which was the next one. There's also a health video, but they're just informational. So on Wednesday, we will start reviewing for the final. Have a wonderful day. I will see you soon.